From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Earlier this month, on October 1st, China celebrated the 69th anniversary of its successful revolution. That was approximately 28 years after the founding of the Communist Party of China, and a struggle that began in 1921 that still continues in some ways today. China is the world's most populous nation, has by some measures the world's largest or second largest economy, and is still undergoing a process of rapid development. For more on that, we're speaking with Professor Luciana Bone via telephone from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Don. Yes, we're going to talk about China. Perhaps start with just the views that are given to us in, let's call it, the West, on China. And let's start with the so-called alleged religious persecution in Xinjiang, which the Western media has been full of since March of this year, intensifying in July, August, September, and going on now. But is China exercising religious persecution in Xinjiang or social progress? You and I have seen, have gone over this while discussing the 1930s in Russia, where, you know, the terror, the great terror, the purges, that's what Russia was being portrayed of. And at the same time, the Stalin was building schools, hospitals, etc. So, you know, to say the least, the point of view is one-sided. Anyway, so it seems that the Western media is launching what I call the terrorism of indignation. It's media terrorism, and it's trying to elicit outrage and indignation in the humanitarian West. And the Atlantic Monthly came out, I think it was in June or July, saying China holds a million Uyghurs Muslims in camps. And it quotes the UN, special some organization of human rights. So, you know, I mean, I put this sentence in Google, in the Google search engine this morning, and I wrote, China is not persecuting Uyghur population. And you know what I got? An avalanche of articles on China's persecution of Uyghur population, from WAPO to New York Times, from Breitbart to The Guardian, from Radio Free Asia to Foreign Policy, from the National Review to the UN human rights chief, not the council, the chief. In other words, from extreme right, so-called, to lefty left, all crying humanitarian crisis in Xinjiang. Of course, we'll just say that Xinjiang is rich in oil. It's rich in oil, and it's likely to be scheduled to be the hubbub of the BRI, the rail initiative, the Silk Road.
The Belt and Road Initiative.
The Belt and Road. Yeah. I mean, it's a key point, as crucial as Afghanistan, on the initiative, on the BRI initiative, and also it's got oil. Now, what this media is doing is the same thing that they did with Yugoslavia, particularly Kosovo. You know, raise an ethnic, raise the flag of of humanitarian rescue for a persecuted minority.
Right, so ethnic and religious, with an ethnic and a religious dimension to it. I mean, we saw this, you know, they did it with the Dalai Lama with China back in the 1950s, you know, with the Tibetans. And they always had the, you know, the left, quote unquote, people here that were concerned about China's treatment of the Tibetans without any acknowledgement that they were defending a medieval cult, basically. And also even the same game was played with the Warsaw Pact countries in the Soviet Union, Mindszenty and the Catholic Church, and some of the prelates of the Orthodox Church inside Russia, and the game that's being played now with Ukraine, with the Ukrainian Church. This is part of the CIA's playbook, is to play this stuff.
The religious card,
And the way they pronounce it at Wikipedia is Uyghurs, but I've heard Uyghurs and others, and I don't know in the native language, but it's a Turkic ethnic group, just for people who don't know. They live elsewhere also in East and Central Asia. We're talking about in Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China, where they're one of 55 officially recognized ethnic minorities, and they primarily practice Islam, those that practice religion. They're genetically related, according to Wikipedia, to both Caucasoid, sounds like a word my old nun used to use, and East Asian populations. And so, well, you know, we're talking about a Turkish ethnic group that lives in Western China that has historical links, if not practicing Islam, that are, you know, they're being targeted essentially by Western propaganda to cause dissension in the western part of China.
Being used. I say Uyghurs simply because it sounds to me like Hungarian.
And it may well Hungarian, be, because they're related.
But
right.
they are a Turkic group, yes. But anyway, the National Review has had a coverage of that. And it said, ethnic cleansing makes a comeback in China. The Washington Post, Beijing crackdown, Uyghur minority is setting a new standard for oppression. The Chinese government persecution of innocents continues. The horror in Xinjiang, etc. This is, I think, the Washington Post. And then we have Al Jazeera. Qatar,
Yes.
They describe a 5-meter-high fence with barbed wire kept the camp secure because, you know, there are 10 million Uyghurs in re-education camps, which has an echo to the Cultural Revolution and what went on in Cambodia under Pol Pot.
Yep.
There's echoes, you know, of former scams. Propaganda scam.
Right.
5-meter-high fence, barbed wire, secures the camp out of public view. Outside, a sign reads, no communist, no China. And that's Al Jazeera.
Right.
Were people destroyed, cries the Guardian on their behalf. Of course, Radio Free Asia, which is funded by the U.S. government, says that it's arguably among the worst, if not the most severe, since the Cultural Revolution. And Forbes says growing religious persecution in China is a symptom of Xi's concentration of power. And let me skip a bit here. I have quite a number. Islamic leaders have nothing good to say about China's internment of Uyghurs, says Foreign Policy. The human rights chief blasts China for persecuting Muslims in Xinjiang, and so on and so forth. But finally, let me see. One is the New York Times. The New York Times says what is what is Trump going to do about the horror in Xinjiang? And now, Freedom House, which we know also is attached to the intelligence services, the secret services, the phony foundation,
right,
or the real foundation that propagate propaganda, it says in its executive summary of 2018, it says that at the CCP's 19th Congress in October 2017, and I quote them, a plan for comprehensive management of all religious activity and organizations and a Sinicization of religion in China laid out at an April party conference further restricted the scope for religious freedom. The government continued to impose conditions approaching martial law in Tibetan and Uyghur populated region of the country. So what is this Sinicization? It's the bringing under government control the appointment of the bureaucracy of churches. We have seen that China has just signed a contract, an agreement, understanding that the Vatican, a foreign power, cannot just appoint bishops without the vetting of the central powers, the Communist Party. And the Vatican agreed, and the bishop that has been appointed is somebody approved by the Communist Party. They don't want to have a Mezaros, or whatever the heck his name was in Hungary, or a Stepinac that was in Croatia, gathering dissent while pretending to tending the flock,
right,
against the government. So Sinicization of religion is simply a provision, not simply, I think it's a provision to control foreign penetration, which we know China suffered greatly from the missionary invasion that it had in its 100 years of humiliation. So this is just a formalization of who rules China.
Right. That's right. I mean, if you take a look at the role that religion was used to play in taking down the Eastern European states, if folks don't remember, there was the whole
starting with Poland.
Yeah, in Poland, you had the workers' uprising, quote unquote, at Gdansk and the other places, Lech Walesa, the shipyards, all of that, supposedly showing labor's resistance to socialism, and at the very moment that this was, addressed and started to dissipate. Suddenly, the first Polish pope in human history finds his way to the Vatican, leaping over bodies of Italians in every direction. And suddenly, Polish Catholicism, rises for the first time in 1,000 years. And now people are going to church to organize against the state, in essence, which is what happened.
Yeah.
Which made me nervous when we saw an Argentinian pope after the last successful CELAC conference. I was a little suspicious about that, but
right,
this is what they do. You had during Hungary in 1956, Mindszenty. There was a Catholic priest in China that was a cause célèbre for the CIA and others as a rallying point of good Christians around the world against the evil commies in Beijing. This is the game they play.
Yeah, sure. We saw the role of the Vatican in the rise of the Nazis. The role, or in Italy, the agreement between Mussolini and the Pope. In
right.
Spain.
Yep.
I mean, the Catholic Church, I don't mean the observant people, the poor people that go to church and whatever.
Right.
That's fine. No, this has to do with power and bureaucracy and control and money and real, real power.
Buy
arms, to fund exiles, Nazi exiles, etc. But the Chinese media this summer counterattacked, and Global Times is government media, Chinese government media, but it answered the attacks, and they said that were mounting. And they said the Chinese ethnic and religious policies in Xinjiang and for the Uyghurs autonomous region have given priority to anti-secession and counter-terrorism so as to maintain stable development. And Western media should see the situation themselves before accusing China, says the Global Times. And they quote I don't know if it's a woman or McDougall, a member of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, who said he was the author, or she was the author of the whole, the 10 million in re-education camp to which the Western media latched on. So they said, the Global Times said, the UN spokesperson said that Uyghurs and Muslim minorities were forced into political camps for indoctrination in northwest China, Xinjiang Uyghur region. And the BBC reported this, they say. But Chinese experts on Monday, that is, the report came out on a Friday, it doesn't matter. It was noted by the Chinese observers that previous terrorist activity in Xinjiang cost too much, and anti-secession and counter-terrorism efforts in ethnic minority region, especially in Xinjiang, have enhanced the security and eliminated terror threats in the region. In other words, what did we do? We went to war on terror, right? Because of 9/11. Now, China is not allowed to have any policies that contains this phenomenon. So it is pointing out, somebody teaching at the Tibet University in Lhasa said, anti-secession and counter-terrorism efforts should and have to be a priority in Xinjiang. And the Tibet Autonomous Region, social development will suffer if the three evil forces, terrorism, separatism, and extremism, prevail in these regions. Of course, they don't say that terrorism, separatism, and extremism are funded and trained and infiltrated by the West, but we all know that's the case. It's practically an invasion by proxy and a destabilization. So, but in effect, what exactly, what is the actual material situation in Xinjiang? The Chinese government listens to local government leaders in ethnic minority regions because they say they attach great importance to poverty alleviation, which could help eliminate extremism. So civil servants in Xinjiang have been sent to remote villages to promote poverty alleviation and to conduct poverty alleviation work and improve the ties with local ethnic residents. So more than 600,000 people in Xinjiang were lifted out of poverty in 2016. The central government and Xinjiang's regional government set a 14.1 billion yuan poverty alleviation and allocated 1.6 billion yuan to relocate residents of poverty-stricken areas. So They have been promoting economic development and improving people's living standards. For example, according to data from the National Bureau of Statistics, the Global Times says, the average income of Chinese urban residents in 2017 was 36,396 yuan. I think it's approximately $4,000. Sorry. Just let me get back to this.
Yeah, go ahead. Because this is interesting.
Income,
yeah.
Income thing, yeah, which I botched. In 2017, urban residents in Jinan earned an average of 30,775 yuan, that is 4,473 dollars a year, while rural residents earned 11,045 yuan, so quite a third less. But that was an increase of 7.8% for the urban population and 8% for the rural population compared to the previous year, you see. So, so the urban, the average for the urban residents in 2017, I'm not very good with numbers. The average income of Chinese urban residents overall in 2017 was 36,000 yuan, while I said 30,775 in Jinan. So Jinan has not been left far behind and is getting close to the urban centers in the rest of China. So, you know, while the West is crying, these poor Uyghurs are being put into re-education camp, 10 million of them, and surrounded by fences, and you're either communist or you're not Chinese, etc. What the material condition are these continuous improvement and a pitch for removing the poverty that allows the extremist propaganda to penetrate. The Global Times quotes officials in Yining saying, as a public servant working at the grassroots level, I have witnessed the rapid economic development of Jinan and its ethnic unity. But economic development under the leadership of a socialist, of a communist party, the road to socialism, is not something that the West is going to advertise. Right. It's not in their interest.
Of course not.
So,
I mean, look, this is one of the things that we hear about all the time. It's a, you know, point of discussion, you know, ongoing discussion among people that call themselves socialists and communists and of the left here in the United States. With some raising the question, I mean, this is the same thing we heard about the Soviet Union. Is it really a socialist, or is it a state capitalist, or is it, you know, something else? It's imperialist, you know, all these different things. And people threw jargon around as if it wasn't supposed to describe some material thing. And, you know, the evidence of the Soviet Union being an imperialist country, for example, which was bandied about for decades by members of the left, quote-unquote, here. You know, the first real evidence they had of it was Afghanistan, and in fact, Afghanistan was nothing of the kind. It was reluctantly, the Soviet Union was reluctantly badgered into coming in to Afghanistan to save the government there from its own errors that were taken against the advice of the Soviet government. And so, you know, yet the left here, it's imperialist. The same with China now. China's a capitalist country. China's not a socialist economy. China, you know, neglecting to even say, well, Even if China is a capitalist economy, which I don't consider it to be, but for whatever that's worth, it happens to be, you know, the capitalist economy with by far the largest public sector on the planet. And, you know, when people are speaking longingly of Norway, you know, or whatever, for, you know, having free tuition or something, take a look at how China's economy relates to China's workers and then tell us where socialism exists on planet Earth right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I posted on China recently, and I called the Western left dimmer than a moonless night because,
yep.
Because, look, let's go over what imperialism means,
right.
And for the umpteenth time.
Right.
So, what is imperialism? Well, we know that China is a big economic power. But we will say that it is neither an empire nor imperialist. People define imperialism in China by the exploitation of wage labor. But that will make the corner grocery store employing one, you know, some students, imperialist.
That imperialist deli up on the corner, the imperialist restaurant down the street.
Yeah, that's right.
Imperialist laundromat and bar, right, yeah, right.
Yeah. Forgetting, you know, that the accumulation of capital that China has done is, it's popular ownership. It's
right.
The people's ownership. It's
exactly.
Their till. People in the West think individually. And, you know, my needs are not attended to, if I'm being exploited, even if that money that I'm exploited by, you know, 10 years ago, has gone in a till that's given me cleaning, schools and stuff for my children. Another thing that the West doesn't think about anymore is the future generations. And China does think of the future generation. So, I mean, in reality, and even if you look at Russia and Western Eastern and its sphere of influence in Eastern in Eastern Europe, how much did it cost to keep this so-called
right.
empire?
Right.
And we also know that the central government of the Soviet Union developed the former colonies of the Tsar. It spent money. It didn't extract money.
Right,
so a better
right.
definition is that imperialism is an extension of class exploitation by violence
right.
assumed under the agency of the nation state.
Right.
It's an extension of class exploitation, extension abroad of class exploitation by the state, which represent the bourgeois class.
We heard in the background the sound of the running dogs of imperialism, but the you know, look, I mean, the point
dogs
is that
imperialism.
The point is that you have this essentially an international structure that reproduces the class structure of the dominant nation states.
Of the nation state.
And if you look to the history of this, the more powerful nation states that were the most stratified coming out of the Middle Ages into the Industrial Age, in Northern Europe, in particular in the UK and Spain and Portugal and Italy, they were the ones, the Dutch, they went around and found colonies and started sucking resources back to the motherland. The upper classes in those countries became the most wealthy upper classes in the world. And the capital that they accumulated still remains accumulated with everything that's been accumulated since, and it remains intact. It's just been handed from one member of the elite to another. And it's kind of the thing we should be targeting now for redistribution to the people. We'll get to this next week because I want to explore the history of China more. We got about halfway through it. And we really appreciate your time, Luciana. And we'll speak again next week.
Okay, thank you so much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.